This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
You know, the challenge to my mind is that we're still stuck in a situation where we're buying more and more things, and we can't continue to consume the way we do and live on a planet with finite resources.
My guest today is Adam Werbach, who could already have been called an environmental activist when he was just in high school. At the ripe young age of 23, Werbach became the youngest person ever elected as the president of the Sierra Club. Now, nearly two decades later, he's working on Yertle, a site that seeks to reduce the needless production of stuff by creating an easy way for people to trade the stuff they already have. Several years ago, he served as a commissioner of the San Francisco Public Utility Commission, and was a pioneer in starting one of the first consulting firms whose focus was to help other organizations become more ecologically responsible and sustainable. Today on Sea Change Radio, Werbach talks about his career, the controversies that arose around him when he claimed that environmentalism was dead and when his company began working with Walmart, and why he feels strongly about the direction his career is taking now. Now on Sea Change Radio by the co-founder of Yertle, Adam Werbach. Adam, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you, Alex. It's great to be with you.
So earlier we were speaking about your latest venture, a sharing marketplace called Yertle. But I want to take a step back, Adam, and discuss your journey within the environmental movement, because it's been fascinating. For example, you were named the Sierra Club's president at 23 years old. First of all, how did that happen?
I had the great honor of being the president of the Sierra Club right after I graduated college. And it was kind of engineered by two people, really three. One was David Brower, who is the first executive director of the Sierra Club and probably the most important modern environmentalist in terms of building the modern environmental movement. He was the one who saved the Grand Canyon from being dammed. And Ed Wayburn, who, was probably responsible for more acres saved than any other person in the U.S., and Dave Foreman, who was one of the founders of Earth First. And all three of them sort of believed that we needed a new generation of people leading the environmental movement and supported me as a student activist to take on that role. Before that, I had started the Sierra Student Coalition, which is still the student arm of the Sierra Club. And I started it in high school after we lost a huge battle to pass something called Big Green in California, a state ballot initiative. And I went around to all the environmental groups and said, look, I've got like 300 kids, high school kids like me, who want to do something. Will you take them on? And, you know, NRDC said, no, they don't do students. And Greenpeace wasn't doing that. And the Sierra Club said, oh, yeah, well, why don't you come to our meeting? And I came to a meeting and they gave me $250 to run a high school training, which turned into the Sierra Student Coalition.
And how long were you at the Sierra Club as their president?
So I spent two terms there. So it's only about 2 years in time. I was truly pretty frustrated at the end of that time. I had to fight a huge battle among people who wanted to make immigration and not immigration reform, but actually keeping people out of the United States as the core priority of the organization, which I was not interested in doing, and nor was the Sierra Club per se, but it was just a big bruising fight. And honestly, I had been frustrated after being at Kyoto for the Kyoto negotiation about what we were able to achieve at that, and didn't believe that we were well set forward to actually take on climate change. So in Kyoto, at the Kyoto negotiation, I had the, you know, kind of the great benefit of representing the Sierra Club and really trying to blow up the agreement, because I thought the agreement was terrible and we thought the agreement didn't really represent what we wanted to try to do.
And apparently even that was still too much for the U.S. to be a signatory to.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it was just what it did was it took the energy out of the burgeoning climate movement and said, oh, look, there's a solution. We don't need to worry about it. And the truth was, is that it was not a solution at all. We knew that. And I mean, I got into a significant row with, you know, Vice President Gore and a bunch of the other environmental organizations around it, because we had a strategic difference. Just thought that, you know, some people thought we should go and take whatever deal we could get, and I thought we should fight. Those were sort of the factors going on in my head, and I was really interested in trying to build a broader movement and use media as a way of actually getting more people involved.
Speaking of trying to move the status quo forward, I wanted to fast forward a little bit to your role as the San Francisco Public Utilities Commissioner. Explain how you saw your colleagues in other roles approach the position. These politically motivated people who use this as a stepping stone for their careers generally.
Well, yeah, I mean, I hope that anyone who's listening to this who has the chance to go serve on a public utilities commission or to put themselves up for it does it, because these are really important institutions in the U.S. and around the globe, and they don't get the attention they deserve. In my case, I was approached by kind of a renegade supervisor, a guy named Chris Daly, with this crazy idea that he was going to become the acting mayor for a day when Willie Brown went to China or Tibet for a trade mission. And on that day that he was the acting mayor, which Willie Brown had sort of asked him to do as a way of just being nice, you know, you're allowed to just kind of ride around in the mayor's car. He was going to appoint me as a public utilities commissioner. And there had never been an environmentalist on the Public Utilities Commission, which is kind of crazy when you think that the Public Utilities Commission in San Francisco controls the water supply from Yosemite National Park, which had been given to the city in the Raker Act in the in the early part of the century. And it really controls water issues, power issues, waste issues, things that are kind of the bread and butter of the environmental world. But it had become a place for, you know, some engineers and a lot of people who were basically politically connected were basically doing the mayor's bidding. You know, the change was to say, well, what would you do? What would an environmentalist do? And once I had been appointed, even though the majority of the board of supervisors voted to throw me out, they couldn't, because in a strong mayor town, if the mayor appoints you, you can't be thrown out unless you have 2/3 plus one of the people voting against you. So somehow I was able to stay, and it became kind of the environmental seat on the Public Utilities Commission. So actually, David Hochschild, after I left, I served, I think, 5 years on it, who was the founder of Vote Solar, took over as in that seat. And today there's an environmentalist running the Public Utilities Commission. So it was a moment of change to actually think about these resources as environmental or ecological resources, not merely kind of the same thing as paving roads.
San Francisco is probably unique in that there's a lot of environmentalists on the Public Utilities Commission, or would I be mistaken by saying that?
I think that most of the public utilities commissions and the commissioners I've met across the country are amazingly dedicated public servants. There is perhaps co-option, because essentially the regulated monopolies, the regulated utilities, like PG&E here in San Francisco, have very close and tight relationships with the staff of all these organizations. So the kind of groupthink that exists in public utilities commission is usually in the interest of the major monopolistic public or private utility in that sense. And the public utilities are constrained so that they can't compete against them. And something like limiting net metering or, you know, limiting, you know, kind of these sort of municipally minded efforts to create competition are usually hamstrung by those competitors. So I think the bigger challenge is not a corruption, but how do you actually get people who are willing to kind of see it, call it, and fight about it if necessary, in order to really represent the public voice, the ratepayer voice, the voice of the environment, instead of just the voice of kind of the status quo.
But that being said, I imagine there must have been at least a decent amount of rubber stamping involved with the job.
There's a lot of things that you're just basically stamping approval on. There's the number of contracts. I mean, when I was on the Public Utilities Commission, I think we probably approved $4 billion of contracts in the period of time that I was on it. So to approve that number of contracts just means that you're meeting every week reading contracts. And you know, a $10 million contract is a big contract. So to actually be able to deal with 10 of those in a month is outrageous. It's just almost impossible to actually have good views of it. So you get into the details of it without actually having thought of, okay, well, how do these add up? you know, what does this actually mean?
You can't look at it from a holistic viewpoint.
Yeah, because you're kind of overwhelmed by the number of actual decisions that you have to make, which are all very important. So is there, you know, is there local hiring in these contracts, for example? It's super important, right? You know, are there local resources? What are the materials? Okay, now we have a negotiation with the cell phone company. What are the cell phone towers going to look like? You know, we have to rebuild a water tower. Is it going to be aesthetically pleasing? We're going to actually, we're building more capacity in the system because of climate change, and we need to have more reservoirs. But where should the reservoirs be? Is it better to have less capacity and actually force people to conserve? What's the, you know, so there's a bunch of questions that ask that are super hard that get stuck kind of below the run-a-day work of running a major entity that's, you know, rebuilding a water system.
Well, they're going to be challenged right now. You were actually there during a period where it wasn't severe drought, correct?
No. Fortunately, we were in the process of building the system at the time. We're rebuilding the system. A huge bond had passed before I got on, and we had a ton of money to figure out how to do it right. And you know, in San Francisco, you really have to worry about earthquakes. So a lot of the $4 billion, you know, at least $1 billion of it was hardening the system and being prepared for it. The challenge at the time was actually the hardening that people were concerned about was terrorism. So we were looking at terrorism as something to respond to protect the assets of the Public Utilities Commission from terrorist attacks, as much as we were looking at climate change and its effects on a water system, perhaps more. Honestly, we were really doing constant meetings about that because that's what America was thinking about. So when you're spending $4 billion, you know, a lot of money can go into surveillance and water testing and water quality and things that have no real benefit for the environment, for people, but just to harden it so it doesn't get attacked by terrorists. And truthfully, it's not been attacked by terrorists, but it has been affected by climate change in the period of time since.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to the founder of Yertl, Adam Warbach. So Adam, you also, is it Act Now or Act mm-hmm. First?
What was Act it? Now. Well, that was actually the idea. Sorry, I read a book called Act Now, Apologize Later, and which really comes from the great piece of advice I received very early in life, which is that when you're trying to do the right thing, it's better to, you know, act first and apologize later. And that was the idea behind this, which is let's build a media company that really begins to, help explain what challenges are facing the world, and then give people the tools to actually do something about it. So some examples of that, we ran a show called The Thin Green Line, which was a cable television show that we ran for 2 seasons, which was basically an investigative environmental show where we went to, you know, went to Mexico and saw how the World Bank was building tree farms, you know, kind of exotic tree farms near Zapatista holdouts, in the word of replanting trees, but they were planting African palm trees around all where the Zapatistas were. We went on cruise ships undercover and watched how they were dumping in the inside passage. Julia Butterfly Hill was actually in her tree at that time, so she was a co-host from the tree, which was sort of fun.
And what network carried the show?
It was on the Outdoor Life Network, which I think is now much more focused on hunting shows.
Yes, yes.
So we weren't really hunting anything. We were eventually canceled, actually, after we did a really powerful show on climate change. And before it was even released, Ford, who was a major supporter of the network, basically told someone at the network that they wouldn't advertise the network if this happened. And so we were canceled. And we were like, no, I don't think Ford is actually against this stuff. But they were like, Ford's just not going to be advertising on a network that's talking about climate change, which is kind of interesting.
But then Act Now became part of Saatchi & Saatchi. And you, why don't you explain some of the work you did there?
Sure. So, you know, after a few years of running, I guess Act Now ran for 10 years, but we took over a video distribution company called the Video Project, which is distributing educational environmental films. And we started on the edges helping companies think through what they could do to actually respond for in terms of true sustainability. And kind of surprised ourselves by being approached by Walmart, and they asked us, you know, they basically in 2004 made these commitments to towards sustainability and hadn't become public yet, and they were trying to figure out how to do it, essentially how to be powered by renewable energy, how to produce zero waste, and how to sell only sustainable products. And you know, when they approached us, we said no, of course, because we didn't want to work with Walmart for all the things that they had been doing that I was personally just appalled by. And then, you know, I was convinced over a period of time that they were serious about it and that they wanted to really try some things.
That it wasn't just greenwashing.
No. In fact, the commitment was, you know, I had it in writing that they were not allowed to announce that I was involved. They were not allowed to publicize it in any way. And it actually ended up leaking. The New York Times found out about it and was the one who wrote about it. And Walmart was great. Like, they were the ones who were... In many ways, they didn't want to get talked about either, because we were really inside the organization trying to figure out how to build buy-in in this company where a lot of people really didn't believe in climate change, where a lot of people thought the sustainability stuff was just kind of West Coast BS. They didn't really get it.
But there was a cabal of execs who were ahead of the curve.
There was a CEO. I mean, it was really Lee Scott and then Rob Walton, in the sense of, as you know, when one family owns 41% of a company, if he's interested in doing it, it's going to happen. And then there was their head of sustainability, their first chief sustainability officer, Andy Rubin. I mean, he was really the one who convinced me. You know, what we did was built basically a training program inside the organization, and went to, you know, basically every store in America and recruited 10 volunteers who got paid time to basically talk to their fellow associates about sustainability. And we worked with all the executives, we worked with all the buyers, and the idea was to basically make sustainability something endemic to Walmart, to figure out how sustainability could represent the really core and good values that exist there.
A lot of people felt betrayed in the environmental movement when they discovered that you were working for this 900-pound gorilla, Walmart, and there were some comments of a Commonwealth Club speech that you made, I believe, where you said environmentalism is dead, and it sounded like you were a little disillusioned by the environmental movement by some of these comments. But was it the engagement with Walmart that kind of gave you a different perspective on solution-oriented activity?
That's interesting. I'd been helping out on the Kerry campaign in 2003, and we created this program called the Apollo Project, which was a major stimulus investment in green jobs that Kerry rejected. And at that time, I realized, you know, we had sort of come up with this really good solution that was good for people's livelihoods, good for my environmental goals, basically a big effort to invest $300 billion in clean energy and clean technology and green jobs. And Kerry rejected it. And it also just seemed to me, as I went and talked to all the heads of the environmental organizations, that no one really had a good plan for dealing with climate change. So I gave a speech at the Commonwealth Club around 2004 on the death of environmentalism, asking really, is environmentalism dead? And concluding that actually the environmentalism that I had grown up practicing, that I had become a leader in, wasn't achieving the single goal that it set out to do, which was to protect the earth so people could live on it. And with climate change, no one had a serious challenge to it. So I kind of gave that speech figuring as my resignation as an environmental activist, just believing that other people could do a better job than me. But even though I'd been successful in the sense of achieving what I set out to do, I had the worst type of failure, which is when you succeed and still fail, which is what I was suffering from. I think that too many leaders if they're not doing a good job, don't step aside. They try to figure out another way to do it better. And the truth is, I was really trying to step aside. I was really saying, I have failed. And I'm not trying to say that everyone else has failed, but I can't see how we're going to get out of this in the way that things that we're doing. So I honestly was thinking about what I would do with the rest of my life at that point. I didn't think it would be environmental work. And so the oddest thing was that I got a call from Walmart saying, hey, do you want to check this thing out? And I was like, oh God, this is just proof that I'm a failure. Like a call from Walmart was sort of like, yes, you are the devil. You are not able to solve this thing. And you know, what I became convinced of is that corporations could, where environmentalists were stalled, particularly during, kind of that period and the Bush administration, corporations could really step forward. And the work I did with Walmart, I mean, Walmart has 60,000 suppliers. They're the largest buyer of, you know, virtually every consumer product on the planet. So what they gave me a window to is a pulpit to talk to all those people. And Walmart basically said, look, if you want to figure out how to sell more sustainable goods, talk to Adam, talk to these people who we're working with, and they'll help you. So I all of a sudden had access to all these major product manufacturers, and I could get in and just say, hey, read these books, you know, check this out, figure out a way to do it. This is the things that you should try to do. And it was it was an incredibly exciting period because, you know, we rapidly exhausted all of the corporate change ideas that had been produced up until that time. Read all the books, talked to all the experts, pulled all people in, and got to a point where there weren't ideas for the scale we were working at. So I started writing a book on strategy for sustainability with the Harvard Business Press. We started training more people. Honestly, the MBA programs like Presidio and Dominican started minting people who were capable of actually doing this type of change process. The big consultancies started buying up the small ones. So that's where, you know, Act Now, we were 50 people and growing really fast. And we honestly didn't have the capacity to serve at the level that we were being asked to. So we merged into Saatchi & Saatchi, which is a global advertising company whose CEO is very committed to the idea of sustainable business. And, you know, he said, look, take this idea that you've done here in the United States and let's do it all over the world. And we built sustainability divisions of every Saatchi office. And Saatchi's in over 100 countries. So we had 6,000 people trained. We had every client presented with a sustainability agenda, and we began taking these ideas, that the things I wrote about in the book, about setting a North Star, about getting your organization from top to bottom to believe in sustainability and make it actionable for each of them. All of those things were being applied across all of Saatchi's clients, so from Toyota to Procter & Gamble. And, you know, for me, that was incredibly exciting. And also I had this sort of nagging feeling all the way through, which was that we were getting to the point of marginal returns. For the first couple of years, we were having huge, just huge impacts where we were seeing that people were finding 100% improvements in energy efficiency, 100% improvements in waste reduction.
But they were starting at such a low level.
They were starting at such a low level. They just never, if you just looked at it, oh yeah, no, they just didn't care before or hadn't, it wasn't the thing on their agenda.
But getting people to care was... it moved the ball.
Well, there were lots of things happening at that time. You know, this is when Inconvenient Truth came out by Al Gore. We had the beginnings of an economic recession. All these reasons were pushing and really supporting this idea towards corporate sustainability. So it's very exciting. That work honestly still continues to this day and is still absolutely important. My friends at Saatchi & Saatchi S are still doing that great work. And there's actually a dozen wonderful consultancies who are helping companies doing this now. So it didn't exist just 10 years ago, and now it does, which is kind of exciting. As this movement grew up, you know, in corporate sustainability and corporate change, you had people on the margins who've been great, like Rocky Mountain Institute, who've been doing this forever. It honestly just needed to scale. It needed to have people who were in the different parts. So you needed to have Accenture get involved in it because they're really good accountants and system people. You need to have Saatchi involved because they're really good at brand and big ideas to change product level. You need to have IDEO. You need to have all these big companies that change other big companies get engaged. And they weren't, and now they are. So that was a great transformation that happened really quickly based on a lot of people's work, not just mine, certainly.
How does one decide that the methods he's using, they just won't jive? Truly believe it. And try over and over again. Living in hopes that someday
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to the founder of Yertle, Adam Warbach. So 10 years after that disillusioned speech when you said environmentalism is dead, if you could put a bookend on that, what would you say?
Well, so it's interesting. I would say that environmentalism is certainly not dead right now, and is beginning to show signs of life. So I would say that the work that we did in terms of building a corporate sustainability effort, that's thriving, and that's going ahead. But the big question that I had in 2004 was, you know, are we set to respond to climate change? And the answer is still a resounding no. You know, I think that the thing that, you know, what was happening is that the environmental movement was looking dull and lifeless in 2004. Today, you know, the Sierra Club and local partners have stopped every new coal plant in the last few years from being built. Like, it's just not happening anymore. You know, this month, 85% of the new production, energy production that was created in the United States was solar and wind, and there was zero coal put online. So, I mean, that change has happened. That change is happening. You know, the challenge to my mind and why, you know, I recruited Andy Rubin, who was the chief sustainability officer at Walmart, out of there to work with me, is that we're still stuck in a situation where we're buying more and more things, and we can't continue to consume the way we do and live on a planet with finite resources. And this is just one of the places, but we basically need to radically change the way we live on the Earth in ways that still increase human happiness and fulfillment and make sure that people are actually taken care of. But it's a cultural change now. It's not just a business change. It's not just a political change. It's a cultural change that has to happen. And that's the work that we're on now.
He's the co-founder of Yertle, Adam Warbach. Adam, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks, I appreciate it.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by George Benson, Bobby McFerrin, and Alan Toussaint. Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Presidio Graduate School in San Francisco, offering MBA and MPA degrees in sustainable management. Learn more at presidioedu.org. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.